I'm going to talk tonight about prejudice. Prejudice is a very, very old problem. It's a problem that Christians have battled for centuries. Prejudice means to have an opinion about something or someone before all the facts are weighed. Now, before we get into this lesson, I want to make it clear that it's not wrong to make a determination, or to judge something fairly, or to judge something righteously, and then decide that you want to oppose it. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 21, says, "But examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. Abstain from every form of evil." We're to decide between what is good and what is evil. And depending on our decision, we decide whether we're going to hang on to it or whether we need to avoid it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and I won't take time to read all of this, but here was a problem in the church where someone had been involved in sin and the church was accepting it. And in verse 9 of 1 Corinthians 5, Paul says, "I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I do not mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. But actually I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he's an immoral person, or covetous, or idolater, or reveler, or drunkard, or swindler, not even to eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the church? But those who are outside, God judges. Remove the wicked man from among yourselves." Notice what Paul is saying. There is a judgment going on. We have to decide matters. It's not that the church decides what is right or wrong, but whether someone is living right or wrong. And in 1 John chapter 4, 1 John chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." There will always be problems within the church of people who are teaching false doctrine. It requires then that we make decisions to whether what somebody's teaching is right or wrong. We have to listen to it and make fair decisions. Christians are to be upholding God's standard. And that standard requires righteousness, just judgments. It requires that we look at the facts fairly and impartially. We are to measure against the truth, not against our own opinions or our own preferences. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and starting with verse 11, it says, "Let each such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present. For we are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves. But when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding. But we will not boast beyond our measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God apportioned to us as a measure to reach even as far as you. We measure ourselves against God's rules. We don't use ourselves as a standard. We don't measure ourselves against other people. We measure ourselves against what God says is right or wrong, the rules that God has laid down. Over in James chapter 2, James chapter 2 and verse 1, it says, "My brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism." That's wrong for Christians to do. We're not to show favoritism. In fact, Solomon back in Proverbs 24 and verse 23 says, "These also are sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judgment is not good." Now, prejudice appears in a lot of different forms. We're probably most familiar with people who lump all people of a certain race or nationality into one group, deciding that all people of that group behave the same way. And we've been hearing a lot about that lately. And it's not just on one side. It's been happening on both sides, where everybody's being just lumped into a large group and assuming that everyone behaves the same way. But you can also find prejudice in the sense of all people being of a certain occupation. Like, for instance, we always tease about how lawyers behave, or IRS agents, or now some people are claiming how all policemen behave. Now, most of us understand, we're in an occupation. Everyone we work with does not behave the same way. And it's wrong then to lump everybody into a category like that and say, well, everybody that's of this particular occupation behaves the same. The rich can prejudge the poor. The poor can prejudge the rich. Prejudice appears when something sometimes new comes along. Well, we've never done that things that way before. Well, does that make it right or wrong? There are, for instance, some people who will only use the King James Version. I've run across that quite a bit, especially down the South, because that's the version of the Bible they grew up with. And it's not based on whether they think that, they will say that the King James Version is more accurate, but I don't think they can prove it. All other versions are basically not as good because they don't read like the King James Version does. I've seen that argument made. Well, see, it's translated differently than the King James, so therefore it's bad. That's comparing yourself by yourself. That's something Christians are not supposed to do. That's not how you decide what's right or wrong. People prejudge things because they've heard from someone that they trusted that it is bad. But they themselves never examined it. Long time ago, when I first started college, I started out in Arkansas. My first semester in college was in Arkansas. It was an eye-opening experience. Because I grew up in the North, and I never ran across prejudice. And I heard people in Arkansas saying, well, I always heard that my pa say that, you know, them black people, they're always up to no good. I couldn't figure out what they were talking about. I had a friend that just, he got really upset. We were walking down the street. I mean, got really upset. I go, what's wrong with you? Don't you see that? See what? I'm looking all over the place. Turned out there was a black man and a white girl that were both working in the fields. They had an agricultural field. He couldn't stand that there were two people in the same field with their different skin colors. I'm going, what are you, crazy? We had quite a few discussions about it. I don't think I ever quite cracked him on that one. It's wrong because it lumps all people of a particular skin tone into a group. It's wrong because the source is another human being who's subject to mistakes. I don't care if your papa said this. He's human too. It disrespects fellow human beings who are made in the image of God. Another one I've run across is, I've had people tell me, well, how bad the New International Version of the Bible is. And when I ask which passage do they object to the most, they can't name me one. Well, I've never studied it for myself, but I've heard awful things about it. No, I don't like the New International Version either. But I can tell you why. I don't like people making strong stands when they don't know what they're standing on. If it wasn't so sad, it's almost humorous to hear, you know, when we first started the Bible Lab, we had those little red books down there that's called the New International Children's Bible. People decided that there was something wrong because they had the word new and international in that title. Because they'd always heard that, you know, the New International Version is bad. And when I asked what verses they objected to, they had no idea, other than they heard that the New International Version was bad. Well, what's wrong with the New International? Well, they had no idea. When I pointed out that particular Bible is actually the New Century Version, just has a title called New International Children's Bible on it, I asked if they knew anything against that particular version. They had no idea either. Like I said, I don't mind reasoned objections. But prejudging a matter based on no facts and no knowledge, well, that's unrighteous judgment. And I'm not saying that to pick on people that used to be here or anything like that. I want you to think about the fact that sometimes, even in subtle ways, we become prejudiced. Christians have always been the brunt of many false conclusions. Take a look at John chapter 7. John chapter 7 and in verse 22. John 7 verse 22, "For this reason Moses has given you circumcision, not because it was from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so the law of Moses will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." The Jews were upset with Jesus. Many times they thought he violated the Sabbath laws. He healed on the Sabbath. It has to be worked. His disciples one time plucked grain on the Sabbath. Jesus never violated the Sabbath laws. However, they assumed Jesus was wrong because it looked like he was violating the laws. And Jesus puts it in proper perspective. They did religious acts, their worship, on the Sabbath day. And that was by God's command. Isn't healing by God's power, and so therefore in a similar category? See, the key is that they were judging by appearance and not checking the truth. And unfortunately, this jumping to false conclusion is a fact of life for every believer of God. We rail against it, but it will not remove it. And so we have to learn how to deal with it. We have to plan for it. For example, Paul, when he was gathering up funds to take to Judea for the famine that was going on there, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and in verse 19, he said, 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19, he said, "For though I am a free man, free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I may win more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are under the, without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I became all things to all men, so that I by all means may save some. Paul would do things not because he had to, but because it furthered his influence with other people. He practiced Jewish customs when he was among the Jews. Not because it was required, but because it allowed people to be more comfortable with him. When he was among the Gentiles, he practiced Gentiles' customs as long as it didn't violate the laws of Christ, because that allowed the Gentiles to be more comfortable with him. In other words, he bent his freedom to serve others who basically were prisoners of their own making. They were the ones who were trapped in a preconceived idea of how the world should work. Over in Romans chapter 12, Romans chapter 12, verse 17, it says, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. We're admonished to consider doing things that look right to other people. And sometimes we will then bend our freedom, just like Paul did, to keep a good relationship with other people. In fact, that's why Paul insisted that when they were gathering up those funds for the saints in Jerusalem, he insisted that someone else carry them. Take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, starting with verse 18. We send along with him the brother whose fame in the things of the gospel has spread through all the churches. And not only this, but he has also been appointed by the churches to travel with us in this gracious work, which is being administered by us for the glory of the Lord himself, and to show our readiness, taking precaution so that no one will discredit us in our administration of this generous gift. For we have regard for what is honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Now, of all the people I could possibly name that I would trust with a pile of money, it would probably be the Apostle Paul. I don't think he would be pilfering that money. And yet, Paul was concerned about how other people might view it. And so he asked the churches to pick out people to go with him, to carry the money. Why? He wanted to have honorable conduct in front of other people. In fact, take a look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. And in verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the things in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Keep your conduct honorable, even among non-believers. And even in worship, we do things that aid our influence that we have over those who are visiting. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians 14 is starting with verse 22. Paul says, so then tongues are for a sign, not to those who believe, but to unbelievers. But prophecy is for a sign, not to unbelievers, but to those who believe. Therefore, if the whole church assembles together and all speak in tongues, and an ungifted men and or unbelievers enter, will they not say that you're mad? But if all prophesy and an unbeliever or an ungifted man enters, he is convicted by all and he is called into account by all. The secrets of his hearts are disclosed, and he will fall on his face and worship God, declaring that God is certainly among us. Could people in those days speak in other languages? Yes. Should everybody be speaking different languages all at once in worship? And the answer is, somebody walk in the door and he's like, what's going on here? They're all nuts. Control over the use of foreign languages in worship service was to make sure that others don't think that worshipers of God are crazy. And there's some denominations that really need to learn that. But what does that mean to us? Well, for instance, we provide checks and balances on those handling the checking account. So there's no accusation that someone's dipping into the Lord's funds. We might also dress up for services because other people think that clothing reflects our attitude toward God. Now, nowhere in the Bible does it say that the preacher has to wear a suit or a tie. And personally, I don't like suit and ties. In fact, I can guarantee that Paul and all the other early preachers didn't wear a tie. However, because visitors and some Christians expect it, you know, I'm willing to bend my preferences to aid my relationship with them. When we talk about prejudice, we need to also hold up that mirror of truth in the other direction. We avoid feeling the prejudice of others, but we also have to fight the prejudice within ourselves. Let's take the matter of clothing. I was asked on a number of occasions to mention something about people's casual dress and service over the years that have been here. Surely there's something in the scriptures about it, is what I was told. And we have approached, of course, we talked about already dress, you know, and the concern about our influence. And I know people here understand it. But I've seen a few better dressed who talk to a client or their boss than they dress when they go to meet other fellow Christians worshiping God. And their clothing says a lot about their attitudes towards the spreading of the gospel. But at the same time, I fear that for many people, the expediency of looking good and binding it into a tradition is no different than what the Pharisees did concerning washing hands before eating. Now sure, washing hands is a good thing. My wife reminds me regularly about that. It's healthy, it's sanitary. But it's not required by God. Sure, dressing nice is sensible. It's a reasonable thing to do. But it's not bound by God either. God does have some things to say about our attire. Mostly, they are concerning being decently and modestly dressed. But I want you to also consider James chapter 2. I find this particular passage sometimes neglected when people talk about dress. James chapter 2, starting with verse 1. My brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who is wearing fine clothes, and you say, sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand over there, or sit down at my footstool. Have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? Listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? If, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you're doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit murder, but you do commit adultery, but you do commit murder, you become a transgressor. So speak and act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless on the one who shows no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. See, just because the world judges by appearance, and we understand that, it does not mean that we as Christians should follow along. God is impartial between the poor and the rich. Hold your finger here. We'll come right back. But over in Job chapter 34. Job 34. And in verse 19. Who shows no partiality to princes, nor regards the rich above the poor, for they are all the work of his hands. God doesn't care whether you're rich or poor. He's interested in you. And that's something we should be as well. Being poor is not shameful. But we insult the poor when we state that their clothing is not good enough. You know, Christians can be monetarily poor, but rich in spirit. For example, in Revelation chapter 2, Revelation chapter 2 and in verse 9, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by which they say that they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Notice, this church was poor. Though Jesus says they are rich spiritually. And God chose the poor as the ones who will most likely accept the gospel because they won't boast. They have humility. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26. For consider your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised, God has chosen the things that are not, so that he might nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. I've had this discussion years ago with several brethren. Well, as long as their clothes are clean. And I want you to go back and look at James 2, verse 2. The word that's used to describe the clothing means cheap, shabby, dirty, filthy clothing. The translation I read out of the New American Standard says dirty clothes. Do you think that because someone comes to worship smelling like a barn, that they don't care about God? Or they have a casual attitude towards worship? When Gay and I first were married, we were up in upstate New York, which is farm country, dairy country. And I knew a man who sometimes came to services smelling like cow manure. You see, he worked a dairy farm, and cows don't wait to be milked. They follow the pattern of the sun. Calves don't come on nice schedules either. Sometimes it was all this man could do to deliver a calf, run in, wash off the worst of the crud, and then dash to church. And you know what? He was there nearly every single service. convenient or not. Sure, he didn't let his convenience determine his worship to God. And sometimes he was a bit fragrant at times. But he stood out as a strong testimony of how to be dedicated in serving God. Sometimes I hear people, well, shouldn't we give our best to the master? And I agree. But what are we giving to God? Am I giving him the attractiveness of my appearance? Could I have asked for a verse backing up that proposition? I've asked many in the past, and I've read writings of many who argue this position. But you know what? I have yet to find a passage where God asked Christians to dress up for worship. In fact, I wonder who people are trying to please. Are they trying to please God or men? And somehow I don't think God is impressed with our outward appearance. Now, yes, there is a song in our songbook. I meant to bring that up here. There's a song in our songbook. It's called Give the Best to Your Master. And 162, thank you very much. I want you to just take a look at the words in 162. Give of your best to the master. Here's what it says. Give of your best to the master. Give of the strength of your youth. Throw your soul's fresh glowing ardor into the battle for truth. Jesus has set the example. Dauntless was he, young and brave. Give him your loyal devotion. Give him the best that you have. And look at the second verse. Give of the best to the of your best to the master. Give him first place in your heart. Give him first place in your service. Consecrate every part. Give and you shall be given. God, his beloved son, gave, gratefully seeking to serve him. Give him the best that you have. And the third verse says, give of the best of your best to the master. Naught else is worthy of his love. He gave himself for your ransom, gave up his glory above, laid down his life without murmur, you from sin's ruin to save. Give him your heart's adoration. Give him the best that you have. Anything on there about outward appearance? What are we to give the best to our masters? The song was talking about, we'll give the best times of our lives to God. And that's based on Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and in verse 1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you say, I have no delight in them. When is the best time to serve God? When you have the ability and the energy to do so. We should be spending our time wisely. That's giving the best to God. In Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16. Making the most of your time because the days are evil. And they're getting very evil. Or what David says in the Psalms. Psalms 90. Psalms 90 and in verse 12. Actually, this is Moses, sorry. Psalms 90 verse 12. So teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. How do we give the best? Give the best of our time. Give the best place in our lives. Jesus told us in Matthew chapter 6, in verse 33. Matthew 6 and verse 33. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. There's where we should be putting our priority. And giving ourselves wholly to reading, exhortation to doctrine. That's what Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and in verse 14. Do not neglect the spiritual gift within you, which was bestowed on you through the prophetic utterance by the laying on. Oops. I want 2 Timothy. I'm pretty sure. Nope. Now I have the wrong verse down. 13? 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13. Thank you. Yeah. And we'll start with verse 12. Let no one look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, love, faith, purity, show yourself an example to those who believe. Until I come, give attention to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation, and to teaching. And the song makes the point that God gave us His best. He sent His Son to die on the cross for us. He gave me a gift that I cannot fully appreciate or offer anything back to Him of equal value. Don't smudge what God has done for us by making rules that God has not given. We need to fight the battle of prejudice, recognizing that it exists, but don't spoil your influence with others out of carelessness or an attempt to make a statement. And don't perpetuate prejudice by jumping to conclusions, especially unjust conclusions, without some facts. I hope you think about these things. I'd like to offer an opportunity. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. For those who are children of God, would like the prayers of your brethren on behalf. Why don't you take that opportunity as we stand and sing the song that was selected.